Previously on Beta.
Do you know anything about ammunition, or do you sell ammunition?
We sell ammunition.
You sell ammunition. All right, what he wants is a silver bullet.
We want you to understand that somebody's always got to be on the job. Somebody's always got to be on the job because there's always a job out there to do.
I'm from Wisconsin originally. Where the cheese comes from.
Oh, but he just loves Texas now. Huh? Don't you, Eugene?
Don't sell that cow.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, 20 years after its release, we revisit D'Angelo's landmark album, Voodoo, with writer and filmmaker Faith Panic.
I have a friend who said at the time, and I think it's, and I actually quoted it in a book, and I think it's accurate. She said, D'Angelo's nakedness is a metaphor for vulnerability. And that's what men couldn't deal with.
And we launch our new docuseries segment on Mel Brooks, Young Blazing Producers. Biographer Patrick McGilligan tells us about what went on behind the scenes during the making of Brooks' directorial debut, The Producers.
He would be very upset if people followed the script without improvising sometimes, and vice versa, very upset if they improvised without following the script.
Recently, I was walking my dog around my building on the ledge. A lot of people are afraid of heights, not me. I'm afraid of widths. I have a 3-year-old dog and named him Stay. He's a lot of fun when he's a puppy, because when I call him, I would say, come here, stay.
That's stand-up comedian Stephen Wright. Stephen has been making people laugh for more than 40 years with his deadpan delivery and his carefully constructed and surreal jokes. He also paints and makes music and is closer than you may think to the prestigious EGOT Lifetime Achievement. In 1989, Stephen won an Oscar for Best Short Live-Action Film for The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. During the acceptance speech, Wright said, "We're really glad that we cut out the other 60 minutes." That's so Stephen Wright. He told us how he became interested in comedy and how he developed his trademark style.
There was a radio show in Boston on Sunday nights, and this person played two comedy albums every Sunday night. I was about 16 years old, and I found it by accident because I was trying to listen to a Bruins game, and you know the Bobby Orr days.
Oh yeah,
and I was going through the dial, and I stumbled on this comedy program, and I had already been watching Johnny Carson all the time, and I had it in my head that my dream would be to be a stand-up comedian. So I heard all these albums. I tuned in every week from years, and I was like studying it by accident, and I heard everyone's albums. Woody Allen had a double album made before he did movies, and he had these jokes within these stories, and I learned like how to structure a joke from him. And I was also influenced by George Carlin in the sense of all his material was like just noticing almost mundane things in life. And then, so when I went to do stand-up, you know, everyone's head is like a soup. It's like made up of different influences over the years, no matter if you're going to be creative or not. It's like everything is a combination in your own head. So then when I went to do stand-up, it was just observational stuff and the structure of a joke I learned from those albums.
With your style of humor, it seems like you need to have so many more jokes than the average comedian to fill a set. What's your process like for writing and mentally storing all of them?
Well, to me, it's normal because I've never done it any other way. I mean, so the joke is like 5 seconds. If they laugh at the joke, it's 5 seconds, including the laugh, maybe 8 seconds. But I've never done it another way, so to me it's normal. I know people tell long stories and everything, but I never think, oh, man, poor me. I have to tell 10 jokes in 1 minute. I don't think of it like that. Right. It's just how it is.
Yeah. So you avoid pop culture material in your act. Is the reason you do that to keep your material timeless, or do you just find pop culture too fleeting?
Two reasons I didn't want to do that, because one reason was a lot of comedians did talk about those things. Mm-hmm. So then I thought, well, if they're talking about that, I don't want to talk about that. And also I was influenced, like I said, by George Carlin about talking about everyday little things like lint and the speed of light and, you know, it's not. And then also then it was timeless.
Like, yeah.
The gravity is not going to be. You couldn't be talking, I mean, Jimmy Carter would be weird to talk about, but gravity is not going to go out of style.
No, it never is. It never is. And lint is never going to go out of style. It's got a long shelf life.
Lint and gravity.
Yeah. And then you mentioned the speed of light, maybe the speed of lint. There might be something. Lint moves pretty slowly, I think. Yeah. Is there a joke? You've written so many jokes, but is there one joke that you can point to as a favorite, or the joke that you've written that you're most proud of?
There is one joke that is my favorite, and it doesn't even get the biggest laugh. It gets like a 6 or a 7. And one reason I like it is because it usually when I think of a joke, instantly I have the wording in the joke comes right immediately.
Oh, really?
Within 30 seconds or a minute. It's like, it's only, to me, my mind, like, it's like a factory and it assembles the wording quickly. And the wording is to have the least amount of words.
Yes.
How can you get to the point with no fluff involved?
Yeah.
But this other joke had this was a weird joke because it took a while for me to figure it out. I mean, I wasn't sitting down like writing it over and over, but my mind was thinking about it. And then occasionally it would come up with it. So the joke was I went to my grandfather's wake, and I was kneeling down at the casket, and I saw him inside the casket, and I was with my aunt. She was beside me, and I started thinking about the batteries inside my flashlight. And then I said to my aunt, maybe he's not dead. Maybe he's just in the wrong way. Now, that is my favorite joke. I mean, no one ever points it out like, oh, that's my But to me, why it is I like the you know, you put batteries out on the table and then you put the dead ones and the new ones. And if you don't know which one, you can't tell by looking at them.
That's beautiful.
Also, there was a giant amount of information to be conveyed, and then when I figured out those that small amount of words to do that, I was like, oh wow, that's pretty. That's interesting.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that with us. In 1982, you got your big break with an appearance on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, and you've been a fixture on the late shows ever since, including recurring spots on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. What is the secret to finding success in the late night comedy space?
The Craig Ferguson stuff, he's not on anymore, but that was a fascinating section of my career because I never did improv before. So when I would sit and talk to him for like 8 minutes, it was all just made up. And his mind is incredible. He's one of the most brilliant comedians I've ever seen.
Everything's connected.
Yes,
I see.
So it depends on how you look at it.
Most things are, you know, dependent on how you look at them, except things you can't see.
Yes, music.
Music, for example. Yeah, music's very good.
Doesn't matter how you look at music.
No, no. I mean, unless you're playing it, unless you're reading the music and then playing it, you know.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'll read music and then listen to a book on tape.
And we would just go back and forth with just insane concepts. I mean, if you ever looked them up and watched them. To me, it looked like, I didn't think of this when it was happening, but in hindsight, it was like two guys were in an insane asylum, and they were in a room, like, waiting for their doctor appointments. Like, they bring them into a room, and this would be the conversation until one of them, okay, Mr. Ferguson, so your doctor will see you now. You know,
with
two insane people.
Yeah.
It was fascinating because when you do stand-up, it's like you're there alone, of course, and it's all on you. But with him, if you said something that didn't work, it didn't matter because he would say something that would work.
Yeah. So that was obviously, yeah, that was really fun to watch because it was a great meeting of two great comedic minds. So, and you enjoyed that, doing improv?
Yeah, I did, loved it because it was just different for me because stand-up was so... It slowly figured out, like, under a microscope. And this was more just, like, making stuff up like you were in a bar.
Right, yeah.
Someone.
Yeah. In 1988, you wrote and starred in the Academy Award-winning short film, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings. This was a hilarious adaptation of your comedy into the film medium. Why did you want to make this film?
Just wanted to see if we could get my angle into my way of thinking into a film version, and then I was going to write it with my friend Mike Armstrong. Then we had to do it, and we had, over the years, I knew Mike since from college. We made so many jokes about psychiatrists or scenarios, weird scenarios, mm-hmm. imagine this and that. So then that's why it was about that.
Yeah.
We had a history of making fun of psychiatry.
Well, it's been bothering me for a while now. I spend a lot of time and energy on it. Something that's very important to me. I want to find out who my real stepfather is. My natural parents won't tell me where he is, but I'd really like to find him. I just have this curious need that I have to satisfy.
It was a great experience, and Dean Pariseau, he directed it, and it was like a big... We made it for HBO, and we had no idea. They wanted to play it in theaters. That was their idea.
Huh.
So then when it played in theaters, it became nominated, and then it won. I mean, we weren't even thinking of the theater world. So it was like we had this dart, like the movie was a dart, and we finished it, and we threw it to HBO, and then a big gust of wind came and made it stick into this other bullseye. Wait, oh, where did it go? Oh, it's an Academy Award. Oh, okay. Yeah. And then they put it on HBO.
Yeah. As you mentioned, this film, The Appointments of Dennis Jennings, was directed by Dean Pariseau, and Dean's wife was the late Sally Menke, who in 1992 was editing Quentin Tarantino's debut film, Reservoir Dogs. You were picked to be the voice of the K-Billy DJ, and you literally became the voice of the film. Can you tell us about that experience?
Well, Sally Menke, she edited Dennis Jennings, and I met her and Dean at the same time, and we became friends, and then she was editing Reservoir Dogs, and it was almost all completely finished. They knew they had the radio section, but they didn't have the guy, the announcer, in there, and then she suggested to Quentin Tarantino that what about Stephen Wright, and he liked the idea. So then, I mean, he wasn't even known at all then.
That
was the first movie. It wasn't the movie, of course, it wasn't even out yet. But I trust Sally said to me, look at this guy. She had edited a bunch of other movies before that.
Mm-hmm.
She said, this guy is really something. This is a different type of situation, this person. And I just trusted her judgment. That's why I agreed to do it. Joe Egan and Jerry Rafferty were a duo known as Steeler's Wheel when they recorded this Dylan-esque pop bubblegum favorite from April of 1974. That reached up to number 5 as K-Billy Super Sounds of the 70s continues. And, of course, she was right.
Yes.
And so I'm happy to be in there.
And it also introduced you to a whole new generation of fans.
Yes, there's a lot of people who know me from that movie who didn't even know I did stand-up.
Mm-hmm.
This whole other situation.
Yeah. You've done comedy for so long, and yet you've only released two albums, 1985's I Have a Pony and the 2006 album When Leaves Blow Away. They've both been nominated for Grammys. I'm just curious, why haven't you released more comedy albums?
Because I like to have a lot of the show where they haven't seen it. The audience doesn't know it.
Right, that makes sense.
Plus, I don't know how much stuff I can think of. You know, I just don't know. Like, when I would go on The Tonight Show, after the first four or five appearances, I had no more material. But I would always come up with another 5 minutes after, like, 5 or 6 months. But then when I started and did that album, and then I did two HBOs and a Comedy Central special, and I like to have a bunch of stuff they don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And your material, because your material is so distinct and so unique that it's got to, even though it comes to you quickly, the wording and everything, as you were saying earlier, that it's and you're one of your unique selling propositions is that you're doing this totally original content, so you're not talking about the things, as you said earlier, that other comedians are talking about. So there's a lot of work that goes into it, right?
Yeah, this jokes are so short, and you know, only for every three I write or four I write, only one of them gets a big enough laugh to stay in the act.
Yeah.
So I mean, I'm trying them out on during these concerts. I'll be trying out some new jokes. So it's like a batting average of like 1 in 3, like a baseball player. Like if he's batting 300, that's good, but that means he got out 7 times out of those 10. But so I'm like 1 in 3 works. So that means you're writing like triple the amount that ends up being in the show.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm curious, what does an excited Stephen Wright sound like?
Like anybody, really.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if someone is win the Super Bowl or some, you know, home run in the bottom of the 11th, I'll be yelling, yes, you know. It's just that people know me. When I'm on stage, I'm conveying the material, so I'm taking it seriously. I don't have time to be laughing at the jokes.
No.
I'm just saying it, I'm trying to remember how the joke goes. I'm remembering what the next joke is. So I talk in a monotone anyway, but when I was on stage, it's so intense. I was afraid at first. I'm not afraid anymore, but I'm very focused. So my deadpan is there because I'm concentrating. So the audience knows me that way. That's why you're asking me what is it like when I get excited, because you don't see me like watching a baseball game, and you don't see me getting excited talking to my friends,
because
it's all known in this one way.
Well, I'm curious, what comedian has made you laugh the hardest?
Oh, in my life?
Yeah.
Probably Woody Allen and George Carlin and Richard Pryor.
Hmm.
And Hannibal Buress, he's like a genius, that guy. And Dave Chappelle, and Unbelievable Mind, and Jon Stewart, and Louis C.K., and like I said, Ferguson, and Letterman. I loved Letterman.
Are there any other arts that you're curious about exploring? I mean, you're one Tony nod away from completing the EGOT nomination cycle.
I just like continuing what I'm doing, and maybe someday do a more, a longer movie, a full-length movie, maybe someday. I did a short film called One Soldier that I wrote and directed myself. It's like takes place right after the Civil War, and it's funny, and it's philosophical, and it's about, you know, all, why are we here and all that, and it's in black and white, and it's beautiful, I think, and I liked doing that. So maybe some more of that sometime. But I like thinking, you know.
Yeah.
Synth and the material, the stand up is from thinking, and I don't see like an end to it, really.
No, well, that's good news for us, Stephen Wright. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good talking to you. Thanks.
Stephen Wright is a stand-up comedian and an Academy Award winner. Find out more about Stephen and his comedy at wpr.org/beta.
Basically, with D'Angelo and Questlove, you have two eclectic, iconoclastic musicians, both talented in their own right, really coming together and just saying, you know what? Let's throw stuff against the wall and see what happens.
Writer and filmmaker Faith Penick on the staying power of D'Angelo's iconic 2000 album, Voodoo. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. In 1995, the neo-soul singer D'Angelo released his debut album, Brown Sugar. After that album became a hit, D'Angelo would spend the next 5 years and over $1 million working on his follow-up. In 2000, he released the long-awaited album, Voodoo. The record received critical acclaim and was hailed as a masterpiece, but was ultimately overshadowed by the transcendent music video for the song Untitled, How Does It Feel? Faith Penick is one of the people who fell under the spell of Voodoo. Faith is a writer and filmmaker and the author of D'Angelo's Voodoo, part of the 33 and a Third series. Beta musical director Steve Gotcher talked to Faith about the album.
Almost the second it came on, I mean, like, because you hear sort of voodoo chants, and apparently we're actually recorded during a Santeria ceremony in Cuba, and you hear it, and I just knew immediately, instinctively, I thought, what is about to happen? Something's about to happen. I just felt it in my bones, and I was mesmerized pretty much from the second I pressed play and listened to the whole album and just stood there and stared at my stereo, and I just was like, this is the guy that did Brown Sugar?
How did growing up in the church and learning gospel music affect D'Angelo's musical development?
He would not be D'Angelo without gospel music. Gospel is in every note that he plays, and particularly when you listen to him sing. I mean, I think two things. One, when you hear him play keyboards, he came up in Holiness Church in Richmond, Virginia. I mean, you can hear that in the way he plays, and you can hear that in any sanctified church, particularly in the South. It's a passion, it's a calling. It's almost like God is being heard through those notes, through those chords, and in the way it's expressed. And the same thing with his vocals. I think the wailing he does, I mean, particularly when you listen to Untitled, that is straight from the gospel tradition. It's particularly going way back when you listen to anybody from Walter Hawkins, Mahalia Jackson, Five Blind Boys of Alabama. I mean, just any gospel music. D'Angelo never walked away from that. And I think in a way, Voodoo was him walking more towards it and really embracing it. You can't take gospel away. It's just as important as funk, as R&B, and as rock is.
Let's talk a little bit about Russell Elovato. You described D'Angelo's partnership with him as brothers from two mothers, and that their collaboration changed the foundation of the entire R&B music industry. What made this pairing so special?
I believe Russell Elovato understood who D'Angelo is as a person and as an artist. And when he came in and mixed three songs for his Brown Sugar album, that was just a sort of love at first sight. I think he knew what kind of artist D'Angelo could be maybe even before D'Angelo knew it, because Elovato is also a very open-minded, curious guy as far as music. He has a pretty wide palette as far as the kind of music that he is really interested in. And he started out actually working in house music. He's an encyclopedia of knowledge as far as music. And I think him meeting D'Angelo, he saw D'Angelo's potential and what he could be. And so when they started talking about Voodoo and D'Angelo sharing with him that he wanted it to be more raw and more dirtier, and Elovato got into that. That turned him on. He was like, yeah, I want to help you get there. And I think he understood what he needed to do as an engineer to help him get there.
D'Angelo put together a who's who of musicians for Voodoo, including a notable collaboration with the Roots drummer Questlove. How did he influence Voodoo?
Questlove, again, another really open-minded, curious, you can't pigeon him as far as his musical taste. I mean, very eclectic. So basically, with D'Angelo and Questlove, you have two eclectic, iconoclastic musicians, both talented in their own right, really coming together and just saying, you know what? Let's throw stuff against the wall and see what happens. A lot of this album came out of just them jamming and messing around. It was very, even the recording of Voodoo was messy for like the first year, in that it was a lot of just jams. And so I think Questlove and D'Angelo just, you know, they understood each other because on a lot of levels they're two sides of the same coin.
And they're open to a lot of different influences. And one of the many influences is the gritty funk of Parliament Funkadelic, George Clinton. And the song where the P-Funk sound really shines is Chicken Grease. What can you tell me about this track?
Yeah, I mean, Questlove said in an essay that he wrote for OK Player that Chicken Grease was sort of an ode or a tribute to the P-Funk classic Flashlight. Even though it has that P-Funk feel and was sort of a tribute to Flashlight, it actually came out of them jamming to a Curtis Mayfield song called Mother's Son. So again, I mean, you have that they're taking those different influences and merging them into one.
Chicken Grease also illustrates the mumbling or the distorted vocals that D'Angelo uses throughout the record. Why do you think he did that?
At one point, D'Angelo did talk about how mumbling was his way of connecting with the spirit. So again, we're going back to his gospel roots, his Pentecostal roots, and really embracing that.
So that kind of speaking in tongues thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of that paradigm. I mean, obviously he wasn't speaking in tongues
right
on the album.
But mimicking it, maybe?
Yeah, mimicking it or just sort of skimming it off the top, if you will. He was still singing lyrics, but I think it was less important for him for people to understand the words as it was for them to understand the spirit and understand the emotion and the passion that he was trying to convey. I actually interviewed an ethnomusicologist from Indiana University for the book, Alicia Lola Jones, and she says that actually is part of the tradition of Afrocentric approach to music and to performing, and that is very much part of the gospel tradition and also a rejection of Eurocentric ideas as far as what makes a song a song.
Speaking of his lyrics, one of the songs that I think really showcases his songwriting skill is the tune Spanish Joint. What can you tell us about that?
Spanish Joint is one of my favorite songs on the album. Whenever it rains, feel the sway. Little something to get me through the day. And you talk about who's who of musicians. He co-wrote it with the late, great Roy Hargrove, an amazing trumpeter who was also a wunderkind. I mean, like D'Angelo, he came out really young and pretty much blew people away from the start. And so when they started working together, just, I mean, you hear it on Voodoo, like how amazing. I mean, between Player Player and Spanish Joint, the work that Roy Hargrove did as far as these melodic and creating these harmonies with his horns. And it just took the album to another level. Also, Charlie Hunter, who is another amazing jazz guitarist, who played a special 8-string guitar where 3 of the strings are bass strings, so he was playing guitar and bass at the same time. It was really a amazing collaboration of jazz artists, but also had this Spanish influence to it. But I really do think that that song, from a musical standpoint, is so tight and just so beautifully constructed as far as the harmonies. And D'Angelo's vocals are just so profound as far as just the range he hits. I mean, you feel like you're walking in Havana listening to that song. But when you get into the lyrics are pretty profound in its own right, in the sense that he's talking about really challenging people and himself to try to push through hard times. And one person in particular to say, like, don't be negative. We have to, you've got to find a way to live your life. You've got to find a way to see it through. I mean, he was in his early 20s when he recorded it. He was 25 when it came out. For someone to be that intelligent and be able to express that level of emotional intelligence at such a young age, how do you write about something like this at such a young age and be so eloquent about it?
Tell me about your thoughts on the track Left and Right.
Left and Right. Definitely one of those songs. It's great for the club. It's a great song to dance to. It's very sexy. But it is bookended by raps by Method Man and Redman that, as a woman, as a feminist, I have to say, it sort of bothered me. They can get pretty disrespectful when it comes to women, and it did seem a little bit out of place with the rest of the album. I don't think D'Angelo's a misogynist. He was going through a lot when it came to women, but I think at the end of the day, he loves them and respects them also. And that, I think he was expressing that on the album as well.
And are there songs that are examples of a celebration of women on that album?
I mean, Untitled, I guess, is the obvious one. The Root is definitely a song where he just sings about being under the spell of this woman that basically, who is basically gonna be, possibly be the end of him on a certain level. She left a stain, left a dirty stain in my heart. I can't refute. No, no, I can't. No, I can't. I think One More Again is probably another example of him lamenting the one that got away, the woman that maybe he knows he should have been with, but for whatever reason it doesn't work out. And particularly if you're the one that ended it, you're like, oh man, maybe if I could go back and change time.
The song most people associate with Voodoo is Untitled, How Does It Feel? It stands out because of a music video, and you refer to it as the video. What makes this video so important?
There was a gender divide with the Untitled video. Women loved it. Straight women, and probably a few lesbians too, loved that video. And I think in part because it wasn't just, ooh, let's look at D'Angelo's abs, but I think it was the sort of underbelly, undercurrent of that video, which really was vulnerability. I have a friend who said at the time, and I think it's, and actually quoted it in a book, and I think it's accurate. She said, D'Angelo's nakedness is a metaphor for vulnerability. And that's what men couldn't deal with. I don't even think it was so much him being quote-unquote naked. He wasn't really fully naked. He was naked from the waist up. But it wasn't that, because if you remember back in the day, particularly with hip-hop artists, that was sort of the thing, particularly for black male artists, black male singers and rappers, was to walk around with their shirts off. But with D'Angelo, it was understood that he was singing to a woman. He wasn't just naked for the sake of being naked. He was singing to your girlfriend, your mother, your wife, your daughter. They already got me right where you want me, baby. I just want you, man. That's when men, and I think particularly black men, sort of couldn't deal, because then it was like they're somehow now gay by even watching the video, and maybe that was bringing up feelings, homoerotic feelings they weren't ready to sort of approach. And also, because remember, I mean, videos back then were very male-centric, particularly in the rap and hip-hop genre. They were making music videos for male audiences. Untitled was specifically made for women. When Dominique Trenier came up with the idea, he was clear that that was going to be a video for women to enjoy. Men weren't used to that, and they didn't know really how to appreciate it, and I think resented it.
Speaking of Untitled, you write in your book, it was the popularity of the Untitled video and the brazen objectification that came with it that contributed to D'Angelo's post-Voodoo downward spiral. How so?
I don't think D'Angelo or anyone on his team expected the video to be that big. I think it was one of those be careful what you wish for because you might get it situations. Untitled came out and really blew up. It dominated MTV. BET was playing it. Everybody was talking about it, particularly Black women. What happened is that, you know, it made D'Angelo a sex symbol, but it started to overshadow the actual album. People were talking way more about the Untitled video than they were about the Voodoo album or even the song Untitled. And D'Angelo started to resent that. D'Angelo got really angry when he would perform and women would be in the front rows screaming, take your clothes off, throwing panties on stage. He wasn't prepared for that. And he really got angry because, first and foremost, he is an artist. He is a musician, he is a singer, he is a songwriter, he is a producer. And no one was talking about that. Everyone was talking about his abs, you know, and his cornrows and how sexy he was. I think that plus losing important people in his life, I think that broke him on a certain level. And I think he lost his way.
What kind of impact has Voodoo had on new artists who have emerged since it's been released?
I think younger artists look back to him the way he, again, looked back to Sly Stone and Al Green and Marvin Gaye and Curtis Mayfield and Prince as the people for him to look up to. I think he is now that gold standard for younger generations.
Faith Penick, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Faith Penick is a writer and filmmaker. She's the author of D'Angelo's Voodoo, which is a part of the 33 and a Third series. Find out more about Voodoo and Faith at wpr.org/beta.
Mel always claimed that there was some dissension among the critics. Sometimes the dissension was in the same review. A critic would say, this movie really, really made me laugh, except for the really tasteless parts that made me cringe.
That's Mel Brooks biographer Patrick McGilligan. He joins us to talk about Mel Brooks' 1967 movie, The Producers, for our recurring segment, Young Blazing Producers. That's coming up right after this. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
I coalesce the vapor of human experience into a viable and logical comprehension.
That's Frankenstein.
Is anybody got a dime?
The Schwartz.
I am Frau Blücher.
I'm not going into the toilet. I'm going into show business.
Zipper Nick.
I didn't get a harumph out of that guy.
Bialystok and Bloom. Bialystok and Bloom.
Now listen to me very carefully. Don't put the candle back.
Welcome to Young Blazing Producers. While that may sound like a Fine Young Cannibals tribute band, it's actually the name of our recurring segment on the films of the great Mel Brooks. Milwaukee author Patrick McGilligan has written the biography Funny Man, Mel Brooks. He'll serve as our very own Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
Well, I guess I was wrong then, wasn't I? Today's installment is Brooks's directorial debut, The Producers. McGilligan talks about the groundbreaking comedy that became a Broadway hit and how Mel came up with the idea.
In the book, I write about where the idea for The Producers came from, and it comes from disparate places. And there had been, in fact, other films about producers who were scurrilous, making money off of their investors and deliberately taking losses and sometimes channeling them to gangsters, etc. Mm-hmm. So there's all kinds of sort of predecessors. And I think one of the things about Mel and his work, which is important, interesting, and distinct, is that almost all of his work is a pastiche of something else or borrowed from something else. He had all these boyhood enthusiasms in song and Broadway and in films, and he followed them along and in various ways poaches from them in work after work. Sometimes it's, you know, quite obvious when it's Robin Hood or Young Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm.
And other times with the producers, it's more obscure and you have to untangle the sources. But literally, the producers had about 10 years of a gestation in his brain. During the last days of his first marriage, he woke his wife up one night and showed her a yellow pad with the first scribbled words of what was then going to be, in its early stages, a novel set in England about producers. And then a long period of time went by during which he began to think of it as a Broadway play, ironically, because it becomes a Broadway play, you know, in the third act of his life.
Yeah.
And he worked very hard at that for a while, but it really took, and this is often true of Brooks, it took a collaborator to come along and really help him put it together almost 10 years after he had first started it. He hadn't completed it. He had not completed anything original of his own. He started working on the producers with an unsung muse who was his typist and also who contributed a lot to editing and sometimes material in the script.
Yeah, Alpha Betty Olson.
Alpha Betty Olson.
Tell me a bit about her and the important role that she played in helping Mel create this film.
Well, there is an Alpha Betty Olson behind most of Mel's films, meaning there's unsung collaborators and very important contributors who, in the case of Alpha Betty, don't get credited, and she didn't get credited at all for the producers. She was happy for the job. She loved Mel and thought he was hilarious. She was a very bright New Yorker who had spent time in college in the Midwest and then went back because she was in love with show business and struck up an acquaintance with Mel in the early 1960s at one of these house parties during the summer out on the islands. They became very friendly, and she became his muse on quite a few projects. Very funny, smart, serious writer who had not really the same drive and ambition to blaze her name in the sky the way Mel does, which really worked for him, and was happy to serve for a while as his muse and as his typist and as his secret helper.
The two main characters in The Producers are the Broadway producer Max Bialystock and the accountant Leopold Bloom. How did Mel Brooks come up with these two characters?
Some people would say it was two sides of the ego, the one outsized, flamboyant, acting out the extrovert, and the other the introvert. And Mel would sometimes say they were both sides of him.
Don't you see, Bloom, darling Bloom, glorious Bloom? It's so simple. Step one, we find the worst play in the world, a surefire flop. Step two, I raise $1 million. A lot of little old ladies in the world. Step three, you go back to work on the books. Phony list of backers, one for the government, one for us. You can do it, Bloom. You're a wizard. Step four, we open on Broadway. And before you can say step five, we close on Broadway. Step six, we take our $1 million, we fly to Rio de Janeiro.
So Gene plays the kind of sheepish, reticent, shy, bookwormish accountant, and Zero Mostel is the lecherous, scheming, greedy producer.
No, hey, Gene, what's the matter with you?
I'm hysterical. I'm having hysterics. I'm hysterical. I can't stop when I get like this. I can't stop. I'm hysterical. I'm wet. I'm wet. I'm hysterical and I'm wet.
How did Mel do as a director?
Even though he had seen every film ever made, it took him a while to sort of get into the role of the director. He would be very upset if people followed the script without improvising sometimes, and vice versa, very upset if they improvised without following the script. But he liked improvisation because he usually cast the kind of people who would bring a little extra to the scenes as he had written them. He could be very, very tyrannical and screaming. And he wasn't, like I say, planning. And, you know, he was nervous. On the first take, he called cut. The cameraman and the producer pulled him aside and very kindly explained to him that you say action. Look, it could have been a joke and it could be apocryphal and it also could be true because he was very nervous. There were a lot of nerves on that production and there were a lot of showdowns between Brooks and Zero Mostel, Brooks and his producer, et cetera, et cetera. That energy, that sort of frenetic energy, and the sort of lack of conventional approach in both the camera work and the staging really makes the film stand out.
Mm-hmm. And as you say in your book, impromptu decisions resulted in some of the fondly remembered highlights of the film. Can you give an example?
They made many, many impromptu decisions. And again, Alpha Betty Olson was acting as his assistant. She was running around trying to figure out how to do this, that, and the other thing to make things work. For example, Mel was a great enthusiast of Moss Hart, who had been his friend. They were going to do a My Fair Lady song as an audition for Hitler, which is kind of funny. They couldn't afford the rights. So Alva Betty is running around trying to figure out another song. And she goes to Lincoln Center to look up music. And she sees the fountain spurting up into the air, as it does periodically. And she thought, oh my gosh, this would be a good climax for the movie, because they needed a new climax, because Mel had written a climax where they are on the roller coaster at Coney Island and suddenly it drops just as they strike the bargain. But the roller coaster hadn't been used for years. It was abandoned and it would have cost too much to get it up and get it going again. She killed two birds with one stone by having this idea while she was at Lincoln Center looking for another song. Took Mel there. He looked at the fountain and great. So that's the, you know, that's the moment where they strike their bargain and jump around and are very happy that they're going to be successful, greedy producers making money off of all their investors by producing a surefire loss.
I want everything I've ever seen in the movies.
Leo, say you'll join me.
I'll do it! My God, I'll do it!
And they cut out the Moss Hart song. They had to. And that led to this marvelous sequence, which was pretty improvised, of all these actors that they brought in from around Broadway who tried out for Hitler in the movie. And it's a kind of a montage of auditions, which is very, very funny.
The little wooden boy. Thank you. Beautiful dream. Oh, does that mean that
I'm sorry.
I'm curious, what do you think of the musical version of The Producers?
I mean, the problem with The Producers, the film, and the property as you watch it today is that so much Nazi humor has gone by the boards,
yes,
including so many Hitler imitations. And Nazis and Hitler are very, very important to Mel's sense of humor. Always were behind the scenes, and then in his films, eventually pretty much of a constant. By the time it turns up on Broadway in the early 2000s, it's tasteful in our culture, and it becomes kind of a smooth return to oldies that you loved. As such, it's great and was a tremendous hit.
The Producers also served as an arc for season 4 of Larry David's HBO series, Curb Your Enthusiasm. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, it was great because on Curb Your Enthusiasm in that particular season, you know, this was before Anne's diagnosis, I believe, her second diagnosis. So you really see the two of them together on screen in this very, very funny setup of Larry David being scouted as one of the two leads to replace the leads on Broadway.
Yeah.
And Mel and Annie scheming for Larry David in order to shut down the show, certain that Larry David would be a big flop.
Yeah.
Which is a very, very funny premise. And then you see the two of them, which is very nice, in this sort of carefree comic mode, playing themselves.
Did you see the look on their faces? When Larry David forgot every line he he went up in smoke.
Oh, God, I'm so glad. I'm so thankful. Thank God that this damn play is going to be over. We're going to get our lives back.
He has freed us from the anchor, from the albatross of The Producers, which has invaded our lives every single minute, every hour of every day.
Trapping us.
No more openings in Cleveland. No more sleeping in dirty beds in Pittsburgh. We're free. Free.
How was The Producers received by the public and the critics when it was released?
Mel always claimed that there was some dissension among the critics because sometimes the dissension was in the same review. A critic would say, this movie really, really made me laugh, except for the really tasteless parts that made me cringe. Even the reviews that were bad usually said, but I really laughed hard, you know.
Yeah.
So people criticized the direction, which they didn't think was smooth and professional and cinematic. And as I'm telling you, it really isn't and wasn't. It became a cult film almost instantly among certain clientele, including young people on college campuses. And it was nominated for and won an Academy Award for Best Script. So that's really pretty hard to beat.
Patrick McGilligan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Doug.
Patrick McGilligan is the author of Funny Man, Mel Brooks. Find out more about Patrick and the producers at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Stephen Wright, Faith Pennick, and Patrick McGilligan. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
Well, my friends call me LSP.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
Let's assume just for the moment that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. I'm Doug Gordon.
That's it, baby, when you got it flaunted!